Okay, now tonight presentation is going to be on the scientific age. And you have to understand there's a basic principle that's at work in all endeavors, as basically God and Satan slug it out for the minds of men. Now, from the beginning, when God created everything, God created it very good. And so, and God's the only one who can create. All Satan can do is take what God has created and pervert it and twist it. See, Satan cannot create. Likewise, Satan cannot engage in an offensive program. All he can do is engage in a defensive, destructive type of program. See, he's got no positive offense where he's going. So, it's in my mind, it's kind of a picture like an NFL quarterback, and he's in the process of trying to make the play that's going to make the big score. The defense, what their goal is to disrupt the offensive plan, see, and to do that in any way possible. So that gives you a picture in a small scale as to how this warfare between God and Satan goes. Now, history is the hand of God in the affairs of man, and it's also then Satan's disruptive efforts to slow down, misdirect, redirect, block the offensive plan that God has. Now, God has an offensive plan, and that plan will be executed. It will be, and will continue, has been, is, and will continue to be executed on time. Now, where we come in is we get to make our choices along the way. And there's a lot of things that impact or affect our choices. So when God engages then in a offensive thrust. Let's take the Protestant Reformation, for example, we covered a couple weeks ago. There was a positive offensive thrust there, sola scriptura, back to the scripture, priesthood of the believers. Those were positive aspects of the Reformation. You had the Bible then printed and distributed in the language of the common man. And the effect then was that there was a tremendous desire to produce a type of government that would ensure the freedom of what they considered God-given rights. Now, sometimes there are those who call them natural rights, but the philosophy that was a result of the Protestant Reformation. It was best expressed in the Declaration of Independence, United States. See, what they did in the Declaration, they didn't have to do this, but they said, you know, when it becomes necessary to dissolve political bonds, then what we want to do is we want to tell the nations of the world why we are engaging in the separation from England. And they said it was a painful separation because it was separating family from family and brother from brother and business from business, all those sort of things. There was a lot of back and forth commerce across the North Atlantic. But in order to answer the question, why were they going to engage in this separation, they laid out the philosophy. They laid out the philosophy of freedom. And then they laid out the breaches of that philosophy that the King of England, the Crown, and his ministers had done, and how that impelled them to engage in what's pretty clearly can be established to be a reluctant revolution. So last week we looked at the Age of Revolution, and there's two things going on. So you have the side then that is trying to follow a biblical model where government's purpose is to be a minister of justice and no more. See, the John Lockes, the Samuel Rutherfords, the economic thinkers, Adam Smith, as these guys thought through these things from the biblical base, they came to the conclusion that the only just government is a government that can only do what you can do. That is, if you have the right to protect your life, your liberty, and your property, then that is a legitimate function of government. Now, if I don't have the right to go down there while Gary DePaula's not looking and get into his wallet, because Gary's a rich guy. I mean, he's got his own business. You know, everybody knows independent business guys are wealthy. You know, I mean, they're just an everlasting money tree in every business. And so tax them more. If I get Gary's wallet while he's not looking, and I feel sorry for Dan up here. Dan, he doesn't have his own business. You know, he has to work hard for a living, you know. And so I feel sorry for Dan, and I take $250 out of Gary's wallet, give it to Dan. Now, was that a legitimate function of mine? No, that's called stealing, is what that's called. So, see, the idea was that if you couldn't do this as an individual, then the government couldn't do it either. Now, that got lost along the way for deliberate reasons. So, when you had the American Revolution develop the way it did, and what was recognized all over the world as even called it the Grand Experiment, and it was imitated in lesser or greater degree throughout the world. At the same time, you had the French Revolution, which was Satan's disruptive program, based on a totally non-biblical base, based on man, based on what was called reason, based on enlightenment. See, the other force that was at work throughout Western Europe. And so you had two totally opposite revolutions there. Now, the challenge, of course, then, the failed revolution, those people are still in Satan's hand. So the challenge, then, is how is Satan going to handle the successful revolution? See, the revolution that took place in the United States of America. Now, what we're going to see tonight in the scientific age, or the age of science, we're going to see how Satan handled it. So we're going to watch this for about 30 minutes, and then I have a few prepared notes and a commentary following that.
In 1609, Galileo began to use the telescope, a newly invented instrument. And what he saw and wrote indicated that Aristotle had been mistaken in his basic ideas concerning the makeup of the universe. When the Roman Church attacked Galileo and Copernicus, it was not because their teaching contained anything contrary to the Bible, but Copernicus and Galileo's teaching did deny the Aristotelian elements which had become a part of the teaching of the church. Copernicus taught that the earth went around the sun and not the sun around the earth. And Galileo defended the compatibility of Copernicus and the Bible. Condemned by the Roman Inquisition in 1632, Galileo was forced to back down, but his writings continued to testify not only that Copernicus was right, but that Aristotle was wrong. Blaise Pascal took a tube of mercury up a mountain and measured the changes in the mercury levels according to the altitude. In this way, he made the first successful barometer. Not only that, but some consider that he's the greatest writer of French prose who has ever lived. He did not see man lost like a speck of dust in the universe, which was so much larger and more complicated than men had thought. For man could comprehend the stars. The stars comprehended nothing. And beside this, for Pascal, man was special because Christ had died on the cross for him. What I have in my hand is not the proverbial apple that supposedly fell on Newton's head. What I have is a heavier object which would have knocked him out. As I take away my hand, it will fall to the ground. But listen, what was that second noise? Listen again. What you heard, of course, was an echo. Here at Cambridge University, Newton worked out the speed of sound by timing the interval of an echo over a known distance. He also came to the conclusion that there was a universal force of attraction between every body in the universe. He called this gravity. Newton's mathematical principles of natural philosophy became one of the most influential books in the history of human thought. It has been said that the 17th century scientists had an interest in the how, but not the why. Not true. For Newton, and many scientists of that period, there was no problem concerning the why, because Newton began with the existence of a personal God who had created the universe. Newton had an intense interest in the Bible, because in his view, the same God who had created the universe gave men truth in the Bible. Newton and the other men of that period would have been utterly astounded at anyone who had an obsession with the how without having a professional interest in the why. Francis Bacon, lawyer, essayist, Lord Chancellor of England, stressed careful observation and systematic collection of information in order to unlock nature's secrets. He too took the Bible seriously, including the historic fall, the revolt of man in history.
Man, by the fall, fell at the same time from his state of innocence and from his dominion over creation. Both of these losses, however, can, even in this life, be in some parts repaired. The former by religion and faith, the latter by the arts and sciences.
To these founders of modern science, man, including his science, is not on his own. He is to take seriously the teaching of the Bible concerning history and the cosmos. And yet, art and science in themselves have value before man and God. This gave a strong impetus to the creative movings of science, not to be merely a passing thing, but to be continuous. God himself had given benevolent dominion over nature to men, and for Bacon, science had a part in this. To find out about the world was worthwhile, because it meant investigating God's marvelous creation. To quote Bacon again,
"Let no man, out of weak conceit of sobriety, or an ill-applied moderation, think or maintain that a man can search too far or be too well studied in the book of God's word, or in the book of God's works."
The book of God's word is, of course, the Bible. The book of God's works is the universe which God had made. There was no separation between religious things and the arts and science. The tradition of Bacon and Newton was strongly maintained right up through the 19th century. The experimental physicist Michael Faraday was a Christian. He believed the secrets of God's creation are for all of us to enjoy. So he gave his famous public demonstrations. The physical world is an open book to explore because God gave it order and gave us the desire to investigate it. Not just for a clever scientific elite, no, for all men. Not all the early scientists were individually consistent Christians. Many were, but all of them were living within the thought forms brought forth by Christianity. In this setting, man's creative stirrings had a base from which to continue and to develop. Knowing that the universe had been created by a reasonable God, the scientists, upon a Christian base, were able to move out with confidence, expecting to be able to find out about the universe by observation and experiment. Without this base, this foundation, modern Western science would never have been born. Without this base, Chinese science, though it had promising beginnings, never came to maturity. There was no confidence that the code of nature's laws could be unveiled and read, because there was no assurance that a divine being, even more rational than ourselves, had ever formulated such a code capable of being read. And this was said by Joseph Needham, an expert on this subject. The same thing could be said about Arab science. Without a Christian base, they lost their interest in science eventually. The Christian base, then, did not hinder science. The Christian base made modern science possible. In 1962, J. Robert Oppenheimer said that modern science was born out of the Christian life form. His field was that of atomic energy. He was also director for the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton. Alfred North Whitehead, well-known mathematician and philosopher, said that Christianity was the mother of science. These views were held both by the pre-Reformation church and also in the teachings of the Reformers. Both held that the universe was created by God and that God is a reasonable God, as the Bible says he is. But we may ask, isn't science now in a new state, one in which the concept of an orderly universe is passé? It is often said that the worldview of relativity, that there are no absolute values and that everything is relative, is supported by Einstein's theory of relativity. But this is wrong. Einstein said that light travels at a constant speed in a vacuum everywhere in the universe. Therefore, nothing is less relative than the theory of relativity. Einstein himself was strongly opposed to this type of thinking.
I cannot believe that God plays dice with the cosmos.
We really do live in a cause and effect universe. If this space vehicle is to fly, it must be constructed according to the existing order of the universe. When something happens, no matter what we may say we believe, we look for something that happened previously as an explanation. If this were not possible, nothing could be explained, and science could not be applied with reliability. Because we live in a universe where cause produces effect, this space vehicle can fly thousands of miles and land exactly on target. You see, cause. The flight of the spacecraft is charted. Effect. It lands where it is supposed to. We know we live in a universe that is much more complex than men, including scientists, once thought it to be. But that is a far cry from the concept of a random universe. What view of the universe did Galileo, Newton, Faraday, and others who shared a Christian base have? They held that the universe was an open universe because God and man are not a part of an all-inclusive cosmic machine. There is something profound in this. The machine, whether it is the cosmic machine or a machine which men make, is not a master nor a threat, because the machine does not include everything. There is a place for man to be man. Later, when the Christian base was lost, the mechanical laws of cause and effect, which had been applied to chemistry, to astronomy, and to physics, were now applied equally to man and to society. The earlier scientists, the founders of modern science, would not have accepted this concept. With it, immediately there was no place for God, but equally no place for man as man. Man died, and love died. There is no place for love in a totally closed cause and effect system. And there is no place for morals. And there is no place for the freedom of man. There is no place for the significance of man. Man becomes a zero. Life becomes pointless, devoid of meaning. The older idea of man as someone observing nature was undermined by the idea that man is something to be observed as no different from all of nature. Darwin, in his Origin of the Species, claimed that all life evolved from more simple forms through survival of the fittest. The concept of an unbroken line from the molecule to man, merely on the basis of time and chance, does not answer either of the two questions of the how or the why, which occupied Newton and Bacon. Murray Eden, professor of MIT, has made statistical studies which indicate that pure chance could not have produced the biological complexity of the world out of chaos in any amount of time suggested so far. Scientific Research magazine has discussed Murray Eden's work in an article entitled "Mathematicians Question Darwinism." Has there been enough time for natural selection, as is seen through the eyepieces of Darwinism or Neo-Darwinism, to operate and give rise to the observed phenomenon of nature? No, say these mathematicians. No one has shown how man could have come from non-man on the basis of time and chance. Tragically, after one has accepted the concept of the survival of the fittest, all restraints are removed. This opened the door for 20th century racism to be sanctioned and made respectable in the name of science.
When biblical Christianity ceased to provide the consensus for German society, when political and economic chaos, as well as moral permissiveness, prevailed, the stage was set for the Nazi movement. Heinrich Himmler, who was the head of the Gestapo, stated the law of nature must take its course in the survival of the fittest. Hitler stated numerous times that Christianity and its concept of charity should be replaced by the ethic of strength over weakness, the survival of the fittest. There were many factors in the rise of National Socialism in Germany, but in that setting, the evolutionary survival of the fittest concept sanctioned what occurred. Humanism had set out to make man autonomous, and it turned out poorly. In a quieter way, and yet importantly, some of today's advocates of genetic engineering use exactly the same arguments to put forth their position. They say that genetic engineering ought to be used for the survival of the fittest,
rather than medical advances being used to keep the weak alive, to be the producers of the next generation. When the Christian consensus died, it left a vacuum, and this will tend to be filled by an elite to form an authoritarian state. When we speak of an authoritarian state, we must not think of the model of Hitler or Stalin, but rather a manipulative authoritarian state. The governments of the world have at their disposal forms of manipulation beyond anything the world has ever known before. Organ transplants are a helpful breakthrough, and we can be glad for it. But to get the needed kidneys and other organs for transplants, the surgeon naturally has to await the donor's death. The accepted definition of death used to be the cessation of heartbeat and breathing. Now the definition is a flat brain wave. This is not wrong in itself, but it opens the door to harvesting the dead. With the brain wave flat, these bodies could be kept alive indefinitely to harvest their blood, to harvest their organs, for transplants and for experimentation. Without the absolute line, which Christianity gives, of man being totally unique, things which are good in themselves can lead to an increasing loss of humanness. For modern man, there is no boundary line between what he should do and what he should not do. And this leaves him with what he can do. Any moral ought is only what is sociologically accepted at the moment. Now, as a Christian, I have a reference point in the Bible. I have a reference point by what it teaches. And in this way, I have something to judge things by. But on the other hand, if I am left without any fixed point by which to judge things, without any cubby holes, as it were, to fit the thoughts that are being thrown at me, I have no basis of judgment at all. I'm just left naked before these things that are thrown at me with no possible way of making a critical analysis.
Many couples today cannot have children because of a low sperm count on the part of the husband. This can often be cured by artificial insemination using the husband's sperm. This is called AIH, H standing for the husband. This is surely a help to many couples. There then comes AID, sperm by a donor, another man. Where is the boundary line? Where does adultery begin? At present in Britain, such a child would be considered illegitimate. In the book, Our Future Inheritance, Choice or Chance, it is written, perhaps the most sensible suggestion made is that the concept of legitimacy be removed altogether. This is not only a change of morals, but a weakening of the family. They make this change upon the basis of what they call social hindrance. It is what I call sociological law. We would all be glad to see the genetic diseases cured. But once the borderlines are removed, which are based upon the biblical absolutes, then humanness can be and is lost increasingly. And increasingly, full genetic engineering is accepted, and so is control. It is B.F. Skinner's thesis that all the people are is the result of conditioning by society, and that through positive reinforcers, society should make people into what it wants them to be. George T. Harris in Psychology Today says, nobody would panic at Skinner's attack upon our idea of freedom if he were only talking, but he has a program and followers to push it. Such behaviors are often found where it counts. At times, they control education in the schools, down to the lowest grades. With all forms of determinism, man as man dies. The determinist has no way to derive his values from what exists, and hence his values and his morals must be chosen arbitrarily. Once this way of thinking is accepted, it is much easier to impose arbitrary absolutes. To quote B.F. Skinner, to man as man, we readily say, good riddance. I think we'd have to say, and it's not trite at all, though it's often been said, that science has become our new religion. We have been conditioned to accept the objectivity of the scientists without realizing that often their views are very clearly shaped by their philosophy or by their worldview. And therefore, having accepted this objectivity almost blindly and having it driven into us, whether it would be the more exact sciences, for instance, astronomy or chemistry or physics, or what now is accepted as almost exact sciences of sociology and psychology, having been accepted, having been conditioned to accept these things, people just stop listening. They just take what they're told without any critical analysis.
It is well known that in Russia, political prisoners are put into mental institutions to be reconditioned, and thus they lose their civil rights and they become non-persons. But conditioning does not have to be so crude in order to be effective. In the West, the flood of books and articles and ideas about psychological, sociological, and chemical determinism has opened the way for the acceptance of first the idea and then the practice of manipulation. People have been increasingly conditioned to be treated as machines and to treat other people as machines. And the technical breakthroughs have largely been made for manipulation. No less a person than Arthur Koestler, the noted scientist and author, has suggested that a chemical agent be developed to rid men of aggression and give him tranquility. In other words, a super tranquilizer. Just like those who wanted to put LSD into the water supply, he suggested that some community may put it in its drinking water so that everyone could get the effects of it.
In this section, I'm giving that which has been reported in various newspapers and news magazines. Kenneth B. Clark, one-time president of the American Psychological Association, suggested in 1971 that all political leaders should have to take anti-aggression pills so they could not be aggressive. And the head of the gynecology and obstetrics department of the Kansas City University Medical School, Dr. Kermit Cranty, urged that birth control pills be put into the world's drinking supplies to control population. And some have suggested that the state could dispense yet another drug to certain households to neutralize the pill. This way the state could decide who could have babies and who could not.
Russell V. Lee, clinical professor emeritus of Stanford University Medical School, said that all public officials should have to have psychological annual testing in depth. And in the case of a high federal official, if the committee thinks it's necessary, the findings could be turned over to a congressional committee who would have the power to remove the official from office. One little thing. The men who dispense the pills and who do the psychological testing will be king. Who will control the controllers? And what will happen now that the line between what man should do and what he can do is obliterated? And if man is only a conditioned machine, what is the value of the continuation of mankind?
The thing that made the difference between the view of the early scientists
And that which marks man today, who sees man as being only a part of a cosmic machine, is not something science has demonstrated. It simply was a shift in the philosophic outlook of the scientists, turning away from the early base that science had of the world having been created by a reasonable God, and the only way that we could return would be to go back to that which the early scientists believed, a God who exists and is not silent. And he's spoken in a way that people can understand in the Bible and in the revelation in Christ. And in the Bible and in the revelation of Christ, we have truth that gives us the key of the whole of life. It tells us the origin of the universe, why it has form. It tells us why man is great, as made in the image of God. It tells us why man is cruel, because he has turned away from God as his integration point and put himself at the center, the fall. It gives us all these things. And then, of course, it gives us also a basis in its absolute teaching for both morals and law.
Turn your Bibles to Romans chapter 1 again. So in this great spiritual slugfest, how fared the ancient civilizations? Romans chapter 1, the Apostle Paul, as he really describes the descent of man. Verse 18, he said, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they're without excuse." See, one of the things that the Bible teaches is that God put eternity in man's heart. That's why everywhere in the world you go, you have graveyards. You have a sense that there's life beyond this one, that there's something more universal. It also stresses that God's nature can be seen and understood through the material universe. That is, that God is a God of order. Okay. So, what happened to those ancient civilizations? Verse 21, even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks. But they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible men, man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. So when God was rejected, when God was pushed out, then man had nowhere to turn but to these images. Now, these images were running parallel a little bit. In other words, God in the Old Testament, in the days of the patriarchs, God was worshipped in a very physical way. That is, the individual would bow, physically bow before God in worship. As the nation Israel developed, then God, in a symbolic form, dwelt in the temple with the priesthood and with sacrifices. So what happens, see, is Satan is countering that every step of the way. Counterfeiting it, see, with a priesthood and sacrifices and temples. Now, when you get to the time of the New Covenant, now, God doesn't dwell in a physical temple, although if he can push, if Satan can push men into thinking that God lives in cathedrals, he will. But God is a spiritual temple. And so what Satan does is then he counterfeits that with also spiritual temples. Humanism, for example, is a religious belief system that doesn't have physical temples. In the terms of the New Covenant, everything is to be sacred. For the Christian, everything is to be holy. Okay, humanism, everything is secular. See, the Humanist Manifesto said that the division between secular and sacred no longer exists. See, that is, it's all that's left is secular in humanism. See, the exact opposite, but running a counter program to what God has instituted in the New Testament. That's what's always done. So, you'll notice that he in the presentation, he talked about how at one point the Christian worldview was pervasive. Even though the scientists weren't necessarily Christians themselves, the worldview that they operated under was a biblical worldview. So, for example, one of the books that I have in my library is Isaac Newton's commentary on the book of Daniel, which, if you want some heavy reading, okay, because that's how the old guys did. They didn't do any light stuff. You know, it was pretty heavy thought, okay? See, these men, as was well pointed out, had a belief that God could be understood, that is, his nature could be understood by observing the creation. And they operated on the presupposition that God was a God of order. And because then God was a God of order, you could do repetitive experiments and it would work the same way every time. See, if God's not a God of order, then what do you have? You do the same experiment, you get two totally different results. Now, that's not your lab experience. Okay, that's. But the. So what scientists look for was beauty in the equation. They look for symmetry and beauty in the equations. So that's how they're able to establish, like, the actual equation that expresses the law of gravity or the Coulomb's law, the law of electric attraction, you know, magnetism. All those sort of things, see, they're actually natural laws with equations that could be determined through experiment and based on the idea that the God who created it was a God of order. Okay. Well, what happened? He said that in Western civilization, you know, the pre-Reformation and both the Reformation time operated on the basis that it was God that did it. It's a God of order. And he said that lasted through the 19th century. Well, what happened in the 19th century? Okay. Some years ago, I published in the 11th Hour Times an article called The Darwinian Revolution. Okay. That was actually a seminal article at some point for people to examine. Now, the Darwinian, why would you call it a Darwinian revolution? I have a little quote here from Encyclopedia Americana. And I selected this quote because it said it in the most concise fashion. It said that the greatest impact that was made by Darwin's book, Origin of Species, the greatest impact made by the book was that the argument of natural selection, that is the mechanism of evolution, worked automatically, leaving little or no room for divine guidance or design. And I put this in italics. Its influence spread beyond biology to all aspects of human thought. Now, the significance of that statement is that there is no God. See, that everything proceeds mechanically. See, so the basis of evolution is that matter automatically organizes itself upward. that is, that which begin as chemicals, lifeless chemicals, automatically organize themselves into the chemicals that will produce life. And that the chemicals in this simple life automatically organizes itself upward to man. See, automatically, it's mechanism, it's machine. Now, Darwin himself knew that his book would have done nothing if it hadn't been promoted. So there was a guy known to history as Huxley's Bulldog. Okay. Now, or Darwin's Bulldog. His name was Thomas Huxley. Right. I have a quote here from Darwin himself. He said, "From what I hear from several quarters, it seems that Oxford did the subject, that is, of evolution, great good. It is of enormous importance in showing the world that a few first-rate men are not afraid of expressing their opinion. I see daily more and more plainly that my unaided book would have done absolutely nothing." Let me translate. Okay. If it wasn't for Huxley and the London Times and the scientific establishment of England pushing Darwin's book, it would have just printed a few thousand copies, stayed in, you know, some dusty shelves somewhere, and would have never had any impact. Here's what Huxley said. "The origin, its origin of species, provided us with the working hypothesis we sought. Moreover, it did the immense service of freeing us forever from the dilemma. Refuse to accept the creation hypothesis, and what do you have to propose that can be accepted by any cautious reasoner? In 1857, I had no answer ready, and I do not think anyone else had." Well, that all changed in 1859. See, it's the publication of Origin of Species. Huxley basically said that until Origin of Species was published, we had no hypothesis to offer except that God created it. Now, Huxley often emphasized that creation was unacceptable, because if creation occurred, then man was accountable to God. And so he makes it plain they were looking for something. 1857 says we had nothing to offer. See, what that tells you, they're looking for something, and they found it. So what happened, see, was not only the publication of The Origin of Species and what impact it had on the scientific establishment, but the fact, as the Encyclopedia Americana put it, it pervaded all aspects of human thought. Okay. Dr. Douglas Futima, professor at Stony Brook University in New York, made this statement. He said, "Within 30 years after its publication, in effect, Darwin had convinced the world of science that evolution was a reality." 30 years? Only 30 years? How did that happen so fast? Well, you have to follow the money trail. So you have to pay attention. Who wants that? Who was promoting it? Who was puffing it? Let me ask you just a simple question. Is Britney Spears that good a singer? I mean, she can't even lip sync, you know. Okay, so somebody was pushing Britney. See, somebody selected Britney, somebody was pushing her. Okay. That's a very small example. You have to understand that something's news because the news media says it's news. Then you have to ask the question, well, who finances or who controls the news media? You have to ask that question, because those are the people going to be selecting what the news is. Who made Darwin's Origin of Species news? See, who continued to promote that and puff it so that the entire scientific community overthrew the idea of a creator and came to the absolutely illogical conclusion that it's all the product of accident? See? Now, he had a very good point in there. The public then has been sold the idea that the scientific community is objective. Okay? That if they have researched something and they have come up with a conclusion, those are objective conclusions. Now that's a bill of goods. See, in the words of Michael Ruse, the scientist is at Guelph University in Ontario, who testified in the state of Arkansas, McLean versus Arkansas Board of Education in 1980. Don't you like the idea of Canadians coming down here and testifying as to what our Constitution means? Okay, but he was the expert on science, and he was quoted by Judge Overton in Judge Overton's decision that kicked the concept of scientific creationism out and enthroned evolution as the religion of the public school system and therefore the government. Okay, because the public school system is an entity of the government. So what applies to the public school system applies to the government across the board. Okay. See, Michael Ruse said that science works against a backdrop or presupposition of no God. So he just states that up front. Operates on a presupposition. What's a presupposition? It's an assumption. What if your assumption's wrong? Now, if you question the assumption, if you question the presupposition, you're not a scientist. That's how they define it. See, and so there's so many guys. For example, there was a man that was selected to be the editor of Scientific American, a very, influential peer-review journal. Okay. It was found out that he was a creationist. He's immediately lost his job because if you're a creationist, you cannot be a scientist. See, because you don't have the right presupposition. So if you begin with the wrong presupposition, then at some point you're guaranteed to have skewed values. So you can't say that it's objective at all. Now, why would the governments of the world want to promote evolution? Because if evolution's true, there's no God. If there's no God, then the philosophy of the Declaration of Independence is false. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they're granted by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, rights of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and that to ensure these rights, governments were instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Okay, as soon as evolution pervades all aspects of human thought, that is gone. That is absolutely gone. And now, what are going to be called your human rights are granted to you by your government, as the government creates them. See, hence it is, we have a philosophy that's been persuaded, pervade, like right to vote. Okay, is there really such a thing as a right to vote? The answer to that is no. Do 18-year-olds have a right to vote? They say they do. How about 17-year-olds? Okay. Do 17-year-olds have a right to life? Just as much as 18-year-olds. See the difference? Voting is a privilege involved in how your government operates. Rights are the things that come from God that no government has the legitimate authority to take away. So that the foundational level, you can see how the would-be tyrants of the world, the modern manipulators, fallen in the footsteps of Hitler and Stalin, how they are continuing to enshrine Darwinism and neo-Darwinism, and how they continue to suppress, by law, the idea that God created it. You see how committed they are to that philosophy. And the result is modern science has to come up with politically correct results. If an individual does not come up with politically correct results, then he is outcast. Sir Fred Hoyle, knighted in England for his work at the British Royal Naval Observatory in Greenwich, England, and developer of the steady-state hypothesis in contrast to the Big Bang, he and his research assistant, Chandra Wickramasinghe, took about 5 years to examine the question as to whether or not life could result by random mechanical action. 5 years later, they published their book. Now, you got to remember, these guys were evolutionists. That's where they were coming from. They thought it would be scientific to ask the question. Hoyle said this. He said the probability that even a simple peptide, see, peptides are small protein units. So the possibility that a simple peptide could develop by the processes of random mechanical action is utterly minuscule. Okay, he's British. Okay, utterly minuscule. I mean, it's not American talk, that's the Queen's English. Okay. It's Sir Fred Hoyle that made the statement that the probability that you could produce a cell by chance is roughly equivalent to a tornado sweeping through a junkyard and producing a Boeing 747. Okay. After the publication of his book, he was interviewed by a guy named Fred Cornell, the AP religion writer, and he made this statement. He said, "We expected our book to be met with a storm of criticism. Instead, we were greeted with a wall of silence." Do any discussions? Suppress the truth. Suppress the truth and unrighteousness. See? You have to understand, see, that the things that we're talking about, the philosophical things, the scientific things, the political things, are being driven by what former Representative Charles Lindbergh Sr. stated, moneyed trusts. The moneyed trusts. The big money. This is our warfare. It's our warfare. It's a war of ideas. That's why it's important. If you're going to be out there engaged in biblical discussions, it's important you understand the matrix and the basis by which modern man thinks. Or doesn't think. So I think our next presentation is the age of non-reason. Okay.